This is Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. A little bit about its history. This year, in fact, marks the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1957 and of the establishment of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. And for certainly many, many years, many people have looked at the department as a leader in the fight for civil rights. Today, however, there are some people who are a little worried that the government has backed away from its involvement in the traditional area of race. So in this part of Focus, we'll try to explore a little bit of the history of the Civil Rights Division with Brian Landsberg. He is someone who has many years' experience working in that division. He worked for the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division from 1964 until 1986. He was a trial attorney and was associated counsel in the Selma, Alabama civil rights cases. Later, he supervised the division's education section and then headed the appellate section. He was adjunct professor of law at Georgetown for 4 years, has been, it continues to be a professor at Pacific McGeorge School of Law, and that's in Sacramento. Then he was called back. He took in 1993 a leave of absence to serve in the number two post in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, where he was the acting deputy assistant attorney general. He's written a couple of books, including one entitled Enforcing Civil Rights, Race Discrimination and the Department of Justice, which gives something of this history. And he's been good enough to spend some time with us this morning. He's joining us by telephone. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Professor Landsberg, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Dave.
I appreciate it. Your association with the division goes back some way, not right to the very beginning, but you write in this book that I just mentioned that you first arrived there in the fall of 1963. In fact, it was certainly not at a happy time in Washington because this was right after the assassination of John Kennedy.
That's right. And so it was 6 years old at the time. The division was 6 years old at that time.
Mm-hmm. You go on, and what point in one point here, saying that perhaps the challenge here is whether, and you wrote this book, and I believe it was in 1990. It was published in 1997, so that was 10 years ago. But I'm sure that a lot of people would say that the challenge continues to be the same, and that is whether this division can stay true to what was its original mission, and that was to deal with issues of racial discrimination and of voting rights, and whether indeed here, as you write, that the challenge is to maintain the understanding and fidelity to mission that informed the early efforts. The danger, as you write, is that the division could lose its sense of mission and increasingly become a voice not of the public interest, but of whatever private interest is in current political ascendancy. So here you were writing this 10 years ago. I wonder what you think about that now, looking at where things stand today and whether indeed the division has managed to stay true to that original mission.
Well, it's always been an issue for the division. The division represents the public interest, not the interest of any particular group. And so even in the 1960s, I suppose that there were times when even though our mission was to protect the rights of primarily of African Americans originally, who were still the subject of an official caste system in the Deep South, they were not always satisfied with what we did. We were, because our perspective was a little different from theirs. But today, what has happened? One thing that has happened is that the Congress has substantially enlarged the responsibilities of the division, so that it now is responsible for combating discrimination based on lots of other classes, such as disability, sex, national origin, religion. It also has gone beyond just doing voting cases to schools and housing and employment and the conditions of confinement in institutions. So it has a much broader mandate than it did in when I came there in 1960. I actually started work in 1964. So I think because the mandate is broader, there's more opportunity or more danger of losing focus. And I think that one of the criticisms or one of the issues that has been raised about the what's going on right now is that the focus has changed to some issues that are somewhat peripheral to the core mission of the division.
Mm-hmm. Well, this here, I think some people have used this benchmark, the 50th anniversary, as an opportunity to at least raise this issue. And it seems that the people who have been doing that are those people who are primarily concerned with civil rights, perhaps for African Americans, but not exclusively for African Americans. And I think that they indeed are concerned that what has happened is they. I'm sure they wouldn't say that they wouldn't argue against the need to deal with issues of discrimination that have to do with disability or with gender or with religion. They wouldn't have an issue with that. But I guess they would say at the same time that civil rights has been the traditional bedrock issue. And that's why the division was established in the first place, and that they would be concerned that resources that might be directed into that effort have been taken away and put into other areas, particularly one that we seem to read a lot about is religious discrimination. And some people have raised the issue, well, is that really as much as of an issue as, for example, voting rights?
Well, exactly, and I think that's a very good example because I think the division was founded to help represent those who could not necessarily represent themselves and people who were in subordinate classes that traditionally have been put in a subordinate position in our society, although religious discrimination is something that is illegal and is morally wrong, I don't think that people of faith have traditionally been the victims of discrimination on a widespread basis or that they are a subordinated class. There have certainly these days there's been discrimination against Muslims because of backlash after 9/11 and I think that it's appropriate for the division to be alert to that kind of discrimination. But they've set up a special unit simply to deal with religious discrimination, and I think that that is taken away from race as a priority. Similarly, human trafficking. Human trafficking is a very despicable kind of a crime. But traditionally, another division of the Justice Department, the criminal division, was responsible for prosecuting those who were involved in human trafficking, and that responsibility was moved to the Department to the Civil Rights Division. So again, what that does is it dilutes the resources that are available to deal with problems of race discrimination. I think there's another aspect of race discrimination that people have been concerned about, and that is that the department has not stopped bringing race discrimination cases, but it's become much more sensitive to so-called reverse discrimination issues they almost in some instances are overtaking the cases of discrimination against African Americans and other people of color. So again, reverse discrimination is wrong. It's unlawful. It is, but my perception is that it is not a major problem in our society, mm-hmm. and that whites are not a class that has suffered from being subordinated the way that other groups have. So I think that's a misplaced priority.
Well, who ultimately decides on the direction and the mission, not just in maybe this larger sense, but also in terms of what sort of issues we're really going to put our emphasis on? I mean, is this something that ultimately is decided by the Attorney General, ultimately by the President of the United States and his administration?
Well, I think that each administration comes in and puts its own stamp on the division, and the courts and the Congress determine what the law is, mm-hmm. and it's the job of the division to enforce the law as it's been interpreted by the courts, but the priority setting is very much done by each administration. And typically, there's been a lot of top-down decision-making with the president giving a sort of a general policy to the attorney general, and then the attorney general gives more specific direction to the assistant attorney general for civil rights. So I assume that that's what has happened here. For example, President Bush certainly was elected with a lot of support from the religious right, and I think that he may have felt some political debt toward them, and that may account in part for the focus on religion in the Civil Rights Division today.
Mm-hmm. The division was set up within the Department of Justice after the creation of the Civil Rights Act of 1957, which was primarily about voting rights. And then there were subsequent acts. There was the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and then there were others that had to do with other kinds of issues. So I suppose it can be argued that on the one hand that what we're talking about here are issues of fundamental issues of justice and civil rights, but it seems that you can't take politics out of them. And I guess I would wonder, is it ever going to be possible that the activities of something like the Civil Rights Division would not in some way be political, and that there would be political forces that would determine how the division operated, but where the emphasis was?
Well, I think that when we talk about political, we have to distinguish between two senses of that term. One sense is that each administration brings overall policy direction to the Department of Justice and other departments. The other sense in which the term political is used is that individual cases are decided for partisan political reasons. And, of course, that has been a charge that has been leveled at the Civil Rights Division's voting enforcement, voting rights enforcement, for example, of clearance of the Georgia voter ID law, mm-hmm. which... it was alleged was done in order to help the Republican Party. So I think, first of all, that most people would agree, I think, that the use of the Department of Justice, any part of the Department of Justice, for partisan political advantage is antithetical to the idea of the rule of law and the impartial enforcement of justice, administration of justice. I think that as far as a setting of policy is concerned, We are a democracy. People do elect the president, and I suppose we wouldn't want the president's hands to be completely tied. I think one thing that makes a big difference is what the composition of the Congress is. What we're seeing right now is with the Democrats in control of the Senate and the House, for the first time since President Bush was elected, there are oversight hearings looking at the performance of the Civil Rights Division. And so I think that that is one way in which people, the political process can be brought to bear to examine the priorities and question the priorities.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Brian Landsberg. He's a professor of law at the University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law. That's in California, Sacramento. He worked for a number of years for the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. He was a trial attorney. He later supervised the division's education service, and then he headed the appellate section. He went on then to become a law professor. He was at Georgetown, then at Pacific McGeorge, and then he took a leave of absence. This is in 1993 to serve in the number two post in the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, where he was acting Deputy Assistant Attorney General. He's also taught at a number of other places and has written a book that explores some of the history and the structure of the division. And I just want to mention that again. The title is Enforcing Civil Rights, Race Discrimination, and the Department of Justice. This book published by the University Press of Kansas. We're going to pause for just a moment here, and Professor Landsberg, I hope you won't mind if I put you on hold here for a second as we take another opportunity to remind folks that this here is our fall membership campaign, and we are here raising money to pay for programs, this one and others that you listen to on this station. And we're raising the money that'll pay for the programs in the next fiscal year. That's the one that would begin next July. First of July. So that's the way our fiscal year goes, and we're always raising money 1 year ahead.
We plan ahead.
That's the deal.
That's right.
That's the idea. And we just want you again to keep in mind that this is a listener-supported station. So that means we count on you to help pay the bills. We hope that over the next couple of days we can raise a significant amount of money and perhaps get some people who have not supported the station in the past for whatever reason to join this group we call the Friends of WILL, not just friends because they like us, but also because they send money that pays for the programs. You can do that right now. You can call us. We have volunteers who will take the call, take just a minute or two, 244-9455. So if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, that's the number. We have a toll-free line that is 866-779-9455. Or if it makes it any easier, it's 1-866-SPY-WILL. Or you can go online, willpledge.org. Jack Brighton is here with me. He's the guy that oversees our web efforts nowadays.
Right. So here's the question. Would you put a quarter in your radio every day to make it come on? That's cheaper than a payphone these days, if you can find a payphone anyway. But you can turn on the radio every day seemingly for free and enjoy great music and news programs for hours on end. And for a lot of people, that's where the relationship ends. But for a very special group of people, the relationship changes over time. They become attached, start to know the announcers by name. David Inge, Celeste Quinn, Tom Rogers, Jay Pierce, etc. They know when a membership drive is coming up, and astonishingly, they give us money. They willingly pay for something that many people get for free. Those are very special people. We call them members. Join WILL, become a member today by calling 244-9455 or toll free 866-779-9455, and welcome to the club.
Yeah. We, as I mentioned here, we're raising the money that will pay for next year's program, so that's in the next fiscal year. And we have set a goal for member support for the year, and it's a big number. It's $2.3 million. That is a lot of money. But we don't need to raise all of that money just in this next 3-4 days. What we've said is, well, what we'd like to do in this fall fundraising campaign shorter, much shorter now than it has been in the past. We'd like to raise $200,000. So that's just a part of our total private support goal. But it's an important first step. So that's why we really would like to meet that goal. We set these goals, and we really do want to meet them. So you can make it possible by calling in and making a pledge. Could be $40, could be $52. That's kind of a nice number because we've said, well, okay, there's 52 weeks in the year. That means a dollar a week. And when you think about all of the programs that you listen to during the week, I think you'd have to say, yeah, that's worth a dollar. If I had to give you a dollar a week for the programs, well, okay, I could do that. I could manage that. So that's one way to think about it. You could make a pledge of $52 or more. You know, you could do it $104. Well, that's $2 a week. Maybe you could manage that. In any case, that's for you to decide. The important thing is that you do pledge. 244-9455. Toll free. 866-779-9455. Or go to willpledge.org and make that pledge because it helps us to keep bringing you the programs that you enjoy. That is the bottom line. Well, we want to continue here with our conversation in this hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad, of course, to have you listening. And we're also pleased to have as our guest Brian Landsberg. He's a professor of law at the University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law, Sacramento, California, and has a number of years experiences working in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. Questions are certainly welcome. People want to join in the conversation, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Landsberg, you write in the book a little bit about the division and how it works. One of the things that you here devote a chapter to, and I guess I'm interested in maybe having you talk a little bit about the fact that within the division you have people who are civil service employees, essentially, who are there, doesn't matter who's in the White House, but then you also do indeed have political appointees, and I suppose within all areas and branches of governments there are. How do these people actually manage to work together, or is there a potential for conflict between the two groups of people?
Well, it's interesting. You know, when the division was formed, it was really formed by a bipartisan coalition. And so in the early days, I would say that political appointees, the assistant attorney general and his top assistants, and the line career people were all pretty much on the same page, pursuing the same goals. Over time, civil rights has become somewhat of a more partisan issue, although everybody says that they support civil rights. There's certainly been big differences between the parties in how it ought to operate. And so every 4 years we have a presidential election and a new president comes in, and that often leads to changes in policy, and the political appointees need the help of the career people to carry out those policy changes. They can't just do it by themselves. This does lead to some conflict. There have been a couple of periods when there were protest resignations during the Nixon administration. There were some during the Reagan administration, and now more recently some very senior people have left the Civil Rights Division under the Bush administration, complaining about the way that it has operated, the way that it's treated its civil service employees, the career people. And I think that the division really harms itself when that happens. The administration is shooting itself in the foot when that happens, because it ought to be possible to have reasoned, transparent kind of discussions between the career people and the political people to come up with a solid, rational, fact-based approach instead of an ideologically based approach to issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, if, you know, perhaps we wouldn't be surprised that a presidential administration, no matter what party they come from, has a political agenda, we might wish that they would elevate principles over politics, but the world being as it is, maybe we don't, we shouldn't be surprised if they don't. If that happens, and again, and, you know, no matter what, could be talking about a Democratic administration too. And if such a thing would happen, where really does the power lie to try to get politics out? And is in fact that the place that you have to go there to the Congress? And if it doesn't happen, then it is really the issue here. It's in a sense lack of direction and oversight from Congress.
You go to the Congress, you go to the public. Some of the people who resigned recently in the past couple of years have been quite vocal in going to the press and are making arguments about the what they think is the wrong way in which the division is being run and the wrong decisions, substantive decisions they think are being made. So I think a lot depends upon also how the public feels about it. I remember a time when people were picketing the Department of Justice because they didn't like some of the policies of the Department of Justice. Frankly, one issue today, I think, is are the American people still concerned about civil rights and racial discrimination, or aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
If we have been having this phone conversation, this radio program 30 years ago, your phone would be ringing off the hook.
Well, if we say that we still have an important issue here, and then we say that for some reason it seems like people just aren't as concerned about it as perhaps that they should be, we would hope that they would be, why do you think that is? Is it, for example, the fact that that media doesn't seem to be talking about issues like that, or that that a lot of people feel that somehow it just doesn't touch them? Or, you know, why is it something that it's not very high on people's agendas?
Well, I do think the media is partly responsible. Except for McClatchy News Service and the Boston Globe, very few newspapers have latched onto this issue. The New York Times and the Washington Post have ignored it, with one or two exceptions. There was one big story in the New York Times recently, and I don't think you hear about it on the television talk shows, that sort of thing. So I think it is being ignored. What I think civil rights advocates are concerned about is that this, in one sense, seems like a return to the 1870s and 1880s, when the country got basically tired of fighting discrimination. The whites in the Deep South were allowed to take control again and to subordinate the blacks in the Deep South. What happened after Brown v. Board of Education and the Civil Rights Act of 1957 is often referred to as a second Reconstruction. And I think that there's some concern that the public has gotten so-called race fatigue, and that the second Reconstruction could grind to a halt. I think that would be a tragic thing for our country if that happened.
Let us talk with a caller. We do have one here on our line one. This is someone listening in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, sir, Professor. You made a comment that I think is all too clear when people of your ilk talk about this conversation in East Central Illinois. It seems like callers go, "Mom." I don't know whether that's racial fatigue or whatever, but I think you raise a very valid point. So to let you know, there is at least one caller in East Central Illinois who very much is concerned about these issues. I want to call in. I'm concerned about an issue that seemingly has been generated by the Jenner 6 problem in Jenner, Louisiana. And some, I think a New York Times article referred to it as a bunch of copycat nooses hanging all over the country. Most recently, a noose left at the door of the office of an African-American female professor at Columbia University in New York City. And my question to you is this type of, quote, activity a hate crime, or is there a hate crime federal law that the Department of Justice should come to the forefront now and deal with what I consider, in light of the history of this country, to be obvious signs of hostility against African Americans that is very, very frightening to one who happens to be an African American?
There are
federal.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Go ahead. He just asked you if you would comment. Yeah. Go ahead, Professor Landsberg.
There are federal hate crime laws, and I think that. This noose that was hung just I guess a day or two ago at Columbia University, I think it was, seems to be an example of a latent racial hostility in a country that prides itself on being non-discriminatory, and yet when things heat up. These sorts of activities kind of come out of the woodwork, and so I think that there is a need to be very vigilant. I will say that the department has done more on the criminal side to prosecute hate crimes, perhaps, than it has done in the voting rights or employment areas. Which are the two areas, I think, where they've been the most heavily criticized.
Okay, thank you, sir.
All right, thank you for the call. And others who are listening are certainly welcome. And other folks like to join the conversation. We have maybe about 6-7 minutes left. 333-9455. That's the number here for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess I'm again, I'm very struck by here. You're in the book here that I mentioned a couple of times, Enforcing Civil Rights, where you talk in part about your own experiences. You write here about the fact that when you first went to work in the Civil Rights Division in 1964, the first trip you took as a lawyer was to talk with a man, an African-American man, who lived in Alabama, who had tried to register to vote. And this was in a place where a county where 80% of the population was African-American, and they had almost no African-American voters. And you would have to say that comparing that time with this time, that things are better, certainly better than they were. And yet, there still is a real concern. A lot of people have real concern about the issue of voting rights.
Well, right. I'd like to say two things about that.
Yeah, yeah.
I have returned to that county in recent years when I worked on my second book, which was about the origins of the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. And I went to what was then the White College in Livingston, Alabama, and it's now an integrated college. And at lunchtime, I went over to a little cafe, which would have been completely, would have been all white back in the 1960s, and their blacks and whites were freely eating together, and nobody paid the least attention. I went into the courthouse, and the county judge and the county prosecutor were black. So I think we have to, when we're kind of gnashing our teeth and thinking things are awful, we have to realize things have changed an awful lot. But on the other hand, the schools in that county are completely segregated. The traditional public schools are now all black, and the white kids either go to a private school or they sneak across the county lines to go to a school where there are more whites in a neighboring county. There's been progress, but it's clear that there's still a lot of racial feeling, and it expresses itself with school segregation, with housing segregation, with still employment discrimination, and with these sorts of episodes such as we've seen in Jaina, Louisiana, and Columbia University.
Mm. We have another caller. Let's talk with them. On a cell phone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Thanks for having the show. It's great. As a person who teaches at a couple of colleges, actually, I will. My experience has been that we have the youngsters who come down from the wealthy suburbs who have had very little contact with any type of diversity as far as race and culture. And then we have the mix of the youngsters from the rural areas, many of whom have never seen a person from another race. And I really think that bringing the schools together, this segregation that's going on right now in the last Supreme Court decision is really a mistake. Without that diversity in the world today, without our children learning about diversity early on instead of getting a shock when they're 19 and having to try to learn real quick is going to be very, very difficult. That's about all I would like to say. I thought I would add that.
All right.
Thanks again for having your show.
Sure. Well, thanks for the comment. That's something maybe you can comment on, not just based on your experience in the Civil Rights Division, but also as a university professor and someone who's been an academic now for some time.
Well, and I've written about this issue of resegregation, and I think that what happened in the, I think you're referring to the Seattle and Louisville cases that the court decided last term,
mm-hmm.
Where the court said that a local school put real restrictions on what local school districts could do to voluntarily desegregate. And I was very disappointed that the Justice Department took the stand that the plans in Louisville and Seattle were unconstitutional, and took a stand against the use of race in any manner to help desegregate. I think that there's a big difference between using race to desegregate and using race to segregate. And yet the Chief Justice, in his opinion in those cases, said there is no difference. And I would agree with the caller that that's a very serious mistake. And I can only hope that the fact that Justice Kennedy was sort of in the middle in that case and suggested that sometimes you can use race to help to desegregate is an indication that if school districts are a little more careful maybe than Seattle and Louisville were, that they can still take steps to bring about some form of racial diversity in the schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's I think at the same time that's something that this ruling, while it may leave some small room for encouragement, has also frustrated a lot of people who work in school districts and who have studied this issue, because it's not exactly clear what kind of plan would pass the test. And I don't know if what's going to happen is it's going to have to be a business of trial and error, designing plans, and then if someone complains and ends up going to the Supreme Court, then they have to wait for it to work its way all the way through the process to find out whether indeed the kind of way that they've organized it is going to work.
Unfortunately, it's not just educators who are going to be drawing these plans. It's going to be educators and lawyers,
mm-hmm.
because the lawyers are going to be looking at them and trying to read the tea leaves of Justice Kennedy's opinion to see exactly what they think Justice Kennedy is going to agree to and what he isn't, because his vote is the crucial vote on this issue.
Yeah. Just as a way of wrapping up here, we have a minute or two left. Do you would still feel that, argue for a very strong role for the federal government in guaranteeing civil rights for Americans?
I think that that race has been one of the core issues that has divided Americans from the very founding of the country, and that it's in the public interest for us to get past that and to get to the day that I think we would all like to see when, as Justice Marshall said, when I can get off the, of course, he was traveling by train. He said he liked to see the day when he can get off the train and have to look at his hand in order to know what color he is.
Hmm. Well, I appreciate, Professor Landsberg, you giving us some of your time today very much.
My pleasure.
Our guest is Brian Landsberg. He's professor of law at the University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law. And I mentioned the book that he wrote now going back some years, Enforcing Civil Rights, Race Discrimination, and the Department of Justice. Certainly, I would like to mention a more recent work, one that's just been out now a few months. And if you're interested in reading on the subject, you can look for this book. And that is titled Free at Last to Vote, The Alabama Origins of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. This book is published by the University Press of Kansas, and it was just published in April. So again, if that's something that you'd like to explore, some history you'd like to explore, you can go out there and look for the book.